and welcome to Irish Passport.
Let's do it.
Welcome to the Irish Passport.
I'm Tim McInerney.
I'm Naomi O'Leary.
We're friends.
Okay, well to Naomi.
Anwar Fad Tim.
This is your passport to Irish culture, history and politics.
Uh-huh.
I'm recording.
One, two, three. Okay.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Irish Passport podcast, where today we are making a quick detour from our Conquest series to talk about politics, what's going on in politics right now. And we're doing that, Naomi, because of peer pressure, we have been receiving so many messages from people, from listeners, and just from people that we've been talking to, asking us to explain what's going on in Irish politics at the moment, because a few quite dramatic things have been going down, actually, in the last few months. So let's take stock of them. There was two referendums, right?
Yeah, so it's been a really eventful couple of weeks in Irish politics. Two referendums were held. The government proposals were defeated comprehensively on both of them. We'll explain a little bit about that later. And then the Taoiseach resigned. Leo Varadkar, leader of Fine Gael, announced that he was stepping down very, very quickly, pretty much with almost immediate effect, which was something that nobody saw coming and caused a bit of a political earthquake in Ireland. With as we record, the leadership contest to replace him is pretty much wrapped up. So it all happened unexpectedly and very, very fast.
Yeah, and the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, it feels like he has been around for ages because even though he hasn't actually been solidly Taoiseach for the past, 7 or 8 years, there has been this period where he's been sharing that role more or less with Micheál Martin. So there was 2 years there where Micheál Martin took the role of Taoiseach and swapped it around with Leo Varadkar. Yeah. So during that time, Leo Varadkar was Taoiseach. And it does feel like he's always kind of been there, right? He's just been there quite consistently at the helm of politics, just for ages, right?
For
so this
while.
Is a big change. Yeah.
So yeah, he was Taoiseach from about June 2017 to June 2020. And then what happened in 2020, if our listeners think back, there was an Irish election and the outcome of the general election was that two former old rival parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, they went into a governing arrangement together. And part of that governing arrangement was that they would take turns having the role of Taoiseach. So that meant Varadkar was Taoiseach or Deputy Prime Minister for a period from 2020 to December 22. And then he became Taoiseach again. So for the last over a year now, he's been Taoiseach for the second time. So we can go through a few things that he's overseen really during his time in power. But like you say, Tim, it does feel like he's been around for a while.
Just to maybe give an idea of how he was understood, I suppose, as a figure of authority, Leo Varadkar was somebody who was quite prominent on the international stage. The fact that he was gay, the fact that he was of Indian descent made him come to headlines straight away when he became Taoiseach all the way back in 2017. And from that moment on, he was quite well known in the international media because of his role in Brexit, right? He was kind of the face of the Irish response to Brexit in the worst years, I suppose, of Brexit, when there was absolute uncertainty. People like Theresa May going around drawing red lines on stuff and nobody really knew what was meant by any of it. And all kinds of ideas like a no deal, dropping off cliffs and metaphors as far as the eye could see. I can't believe I just made a metaphor out of that sentence. Excuse me, listeners. He was on international headlines. His face was on international newspapers fairly consistently during that period. Now, I suppose you could say that he was seen as well as kind of part of this coterie of centre-right, younger, dynamic figures, the kind of Macron-type, politicians that emerged as well around this period. I mean, how would you say he was received, do you think, Naomi, around the world during that time?
It's really interesting because there's a kind of split between his international perception and how he was perceived domestically. So internationally, I think he was really seen as symbolizing this new Ireland, particularly in the wake of the socially progressive referendum results that we had, first on equal marriage, allowing same-sex marriages, and then on legalizing abortion. He was associated with this sort of new Ireland that was emerging, that was a little bit different. If we put things in the international context, I think he was the only the fifth openly gay head of government in the world. So it was, you know, quite a change in international perceptions for a country that was seen as conservative and Catholic for a very long time. At home, however, you know, he was never seen as particularly progressive, which is kind of interesting. He was seen as someone who was like small C conservative. He's a doctor. That's his background. He has a medical background, but very much steeped in the Fine Gael tradition. And he wasn't seen as someone who was sort of pushing the envelope on progressive issues. He was already an established politician when he did come out. And he had some reservations prior to that, I believe, about some rights for gay people. So he had a kind of political journey on that. His perception in Ireland as well, he's widely seen as as like a right-wing figure, although that does need to be seen within the Irish political context. Internationally, he would be more seen as a centrist, even in some places, perhaps centre-left. But I think he was a very unusual politician, very unusual in Ireland, particularly in that he was good sort of on the television, very good at dealing with reporters. He was kind of seen as a frank speaker, straightforward speaker. But he wasn't a classic politician in the old mold of the guy who goes around shaking hands and kissing babies and just has that real common touch and is charming with people. That's the sort of classic mode of an Irish politician. And Leo Varadkar is really not like that. He's actually quite personally awkward. So he's quite different. And I think for Fine Gael, they really hoped that he would be this great vote winner, that he would be sort of the almost glamorous figure, you know, this young guy who stood out, who was dynamic and who was going to win loads of votes. But he didn't actually, that didn't quite materialize for him. In the 2020 election, the party didn't do as well as it hoped and was forced to go into, coalition with Fianna Fáil. And I don't think the party ever really quite dealt with that, but it probably meant that the prospect of a new election wasn't particularly attractive to Varadkar. And it's worth saying as well that domestically, although he was seen as this really strong voice on Brexit internationally, who stood up for Ireland, there was this huge issue of the housing crisis, which wasn't dealt with during the period of when he was in power and just got worse and worse. Even though, I mean, speaking for this podcast, I think we made a podcast back in 2018 about the housing crisis and how serious it was. That was a time when the Irish government wasn't really taking it seriously still. And, you know, part of that is on him. I mean, he was Taoiseach at the time. And it took him, I think, not just him, but a lot of the ruling politicians too long to realise how much of a serious issue that was. And I think it didn't play in his favour that he can come across as not the most empathetic politician. That's not to say anything about what his actual character is like. It's just his communication style.
Right, yeah. And I suppose all of that kind of demonstrates or puts into context this understanding of him as a right-wing politician.
Yeah.
Like you said, of course, I mean, we've talked about it so many times on the podcast, we won't rehash, but this history of the two main parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, having been born from the Civil War, makes the right and left division in Ireland just not very obvious or not very easy to make. Mm. And Fine Gael, more than Fianna Fáil, always seems to have styled itself as the right of Ireland, or the centre-right anyway, politically in Ireland. And that was in a context where Fianna Fáil was extremely socially conservative, in fact, socially conservative to the point of, like, you know, almost being notorious globally, right, in the kind of societies that they were at the helm of during the 1970s and 80s.
Like being opposed to divorce and stuff like that at a time where it would have been quite normal.
Like opposed to women having jobs after they get married, things like this, you know, and still a lot of them even opposing the repeal referendums and the gay marriage referendums during that time. That was what was not the right wing, apparently, during that time. So how are you supposed to really talk about the right wing in that context, right? So Fine Gael defining itself as a right wing party always would have seen that in financial or fiscal terms, I suppose, primarily,
that's right.
because that's really what they were talking about. And that's where we get this, you know, it isn't a contradiction in terms that someone like Leo Varadkar could be socially very progressive, or when he wanted to be, and economically extremely conservative. And, you know, that's, I suppose, something maybe that international commentators can't quite get their minds around, because it doesn't go very well with the mold. But like what you say, Naomi, of course, exactly. In Ireland, his overwhelming legacy, I feel, is the housing crisis. And not just the housing crisis, but a huge lack of investment. I'm not putting this all at his door, by the way, but, you know, that he was manning the ship when this happened.
Yeah.
A huge lack of investment in public infrastructure, full stop. Like the state of public infrastructure in Ireland in the last 15 years is really shocking.
It's been at a standstill. Yeah,
it's been at a complete standstill for about 15 years, basically since the crash. Like we saw there, what, a few months ago, there's not enough police. You know, there was a riot and there weren't enough police. For ages, there haven't been enough beds in hospitals. There aren't enough doctors. There aren't enough homes. There aren't enough homes for people to live in. A statistic I think I may have seen in the Irish Times, but I won't actually quote you on that, Naomi, that came to my attention recently was that 68% of adults between the ages of 18 and 34 in Ireland are living with their parents. 68%. Like this is not culturally normal. I know there's some countries like maybe in, you know, the south of Europe where that's a lot more normal to live with your parents that long. It is not normal in Ireland. Most youngsters are out of the house by the age of 18 at the very latest, really. It's quite unusual not to be. So, you know, like this is massive. Like there's the shortage of buses. There's practically no public transport in Ireland at the moment. Or rather, I mean, public transport was bad 15 years ago. The population has risen since then. The cities have grown since then. And public transport hasn't changed at all. In the village where I live, which has thousands of people now, thousands, thousands and thousands of people, I think there's 5 buses a day. And those same buses service all of Connemara. You know, 5 buses. Like, that was the same as in the 1980s. And it's 2024. So there is this feeling that public services have been hollowed out in Ireland in the last 15 years, just due to sheer neglect. I'm kind of going on a bit of a rant about that. And again, like, this isn't necessarily all Leo Varadkar's fault by any means, but that's, I feel like that's what people think of primarily when they think of him at the moment in Ireland.
I think we can understand that by looking at how Fine Gael styles itself as a fiscally responsible party, first of all. So, you know, a party that's not going to raid your income for extra taxes, a party that isn't going to like spend irresponsibly. At one point, I remember Varadkar said something like they would be the party for people who get up early in the morning. You know, he's toyed with that kind of that rhetoric, which is a bit like a previous generation of the Conservative Party in the UK. That I think that impression, you know, it became very crystallized in people's minds of him. And like you say, there's been this massive missed opportunity in the wake of Ireland's huge economic crisis. There was a period of massive austerity, huge austerity, and there many public spending projects were cancelled, and the idea of public spending itself almost stigmatized. But then the economy turned around. Ireland actually started raking in tax revenue, and the investment clearly has not kept up with the needs of the population, as you point out in a number of different areas, Tim. Now, if you ask the government, they'll say, we introduced way more buses in rural areas in this whole program. They'll say, we took all these measures to address the housing crisis, and now house building has got to its highest level than it's been in years, and so on. So that, you know, they'll have things to defend itself. But the reality is that the shortages set in way before they began to be adequately addressed. And, you know, the stuff like the fact that Dublin doesn't have a metro and it's going to take decades before it could have one. It really does kind of compare poorly to other European capitals in that respect, especially when you see, I don't know if you've had this experience, Tim, but just looking at the rate of change of infrastructure in other European cities that you might visit. Like, I visited the French city of Nice and I saw that they'd built a tram line to the airport. And, you know, it's a comparable size to Dublin, but it's a regional city. It's not like a main capital. And you just wonder, you know, why is it possible for other countries to just build things like that in a few years, whereas, you know, in Ireland, it seems to be impossible. But anyway, we're all kind of opening the floodgates on our grievances somehow with this particular topic. Yeah.
but let's rein it in. And I actually,
we'll rein it in. Yeah.
I want to actually bring in a point there to be fair on Fine Gael.
Yeah.
That Fianna Fáil was at the helm of that for 2 years. Just yes. not so long yeah. ago. Fianna Fáil came in and had 2 years there to fix all of that if they wanted to, you know, if they were so much better. And everything stayed exactly the same as well. So maybe this is part of the kind of public grievance, or this kind of like mounting public grievances, that there was this impression that we've talked about before of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael just becoming this monolith of kind of old, not very bothered establishment figures who weren't
a little bit complacent.
Anything. Complacent is the word. Yeah.
That's perception. And of course, they've been in government now for so many years that, yeah, it's kind of, for those who said that there wasn't a difference between the parties, it's become a little bit more difficult for them to distinguish themselves. But really interesting. I do have a story about Leo Varadkar to share, which happened during the COVID-19 pandemic. So as I mentioned earlier, Leo Varadkar studied medicine. He's a doctor. He comes from a real medical family. His mom is an Irish nurse, I think, and his dad is a doctor from India originally. And they met, I believe, working for the NHS. So it's really, you know, it's in his bones. So shortly after the pandemic took hold, I was contacted by a source who said they were someone who was working in the healthcare system. And they said that they had called a sort of hotline for people at that time. There was a kind of a COVID hotline for health workers who were concerned that they might have it or needed advice or something like that. And they were put through to telemedicine service that was then available. And the person who answered the phone was introduced as Dr. Varadkar and had a very familiar voice. And they spoke to Dr. Varadkar, and so it went. And then between one thing and another, they ended up reaching out to me and they said, I think he's actually gone back to practicing medicine. So this was a time when he was in government. He was a senior politician and they were handling the COVID crisis at the time. So I checked the medical register. I confirmed that Leo Varadkar had indeed re-registered as a doctor, and used some other sources that I knew, and I established that it was true. He'd actually secretly gone back to practicing medicine during the COVID crisis to help out, I guess. It was a time, I don't know if you remember, but early on in the pandemic, many retired doctors and people who might not be practicing at the moment were called to help, you know, to re-register and help the health service because they were concerned about it being overwhelmed. So he did that, and he did it without telling anybody. So, I mean, I found out about it through this person who happened to recognize his voice on a phone call. And I have to say that at the time when I kind of went to get official comment about it, there was actually a lot of pushback and, you know, from Varadkar's side, they did not want me to publish that story. So he wasn't doing it as a kind of publicity stunt. So I've always thought that that's a kind of secret side to Varadkar that, you know, that kind of speaks well of him. What it told me as well is perhaps something that's relevant to his resignation. He seems to, you know, kind of be aware or wistful for a life beyond politics. It's worth noting, I think his partner as well is also a doctor. So, you know, back in 2020, when the pandemic was raging, he was looking for other, maybe more direct ways to sort of help people than what he was able to do as a politician. So I think that's kind of interesting. And my perception is since then, I kind of view his resignation, or I, you know, I don't have very much insight into his personal motivations. In his announcement, he said it was a mixture of personal and professional motivations. But what I have noticed is that he does seem to be a guy who kind of wants to live his life. Sometimes pictures have emerged of him at concerts or, you know, I don't know, enjoying some cans in the park, things like that with friends. I've heard stories about him trying to get into cool nightclubs in Berlin, this kind of thing. But my sense is that, yeah, he kind of he saw life beyond politics, and perhaps this intensified after the pandemic in a way that maybe happened for a lot of people in their careers after that kind of period of upheaval and reflection that many of us went through.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. And keeping in mind that he's young, like this is still a fairly young man. He has a long life ahead of him. And he's taken, you know, a good toll now, like that is quite a stint in politics that he's just done, like going through Brexit and the pandemic. Like mm-hmm. that was two things. I think that's enough for an entire political career. And, you know, during a lot of that time, like to say something for him, by the way, during Brexit and the pandemic, actually, it was some of those moments where I felt anyway that people were relieved that there was a grown up in charge. At a mm-hmm. time in the world where not everyone had that luxury of having grown-ups in charge, where Donald Trump was in charge of the USA and where Boris Johnson was in charge of the UK, both of them just kind of like faffing around, saying silly media bites and, you know, whatever, trying to make headlines or distract people or just anything but serious politics. It was during those crises that it was nice to have somebody who was serious, or at least just, yeah, somebody who had the sense of a grown-up around them.
I think you're hitting on something there, Tim. Yeah, because he does often give frank remarks about the limitations of what's possible in a way that isn't true for fantasy politicians, the politicians who deal in what people want to be true and so on. So he'll say, you know, well, that would be nice, but realistically we have this. That's a very typical Varadkar kind of answer to a question. So he can be a little bit unusual as a politician in that regard. And also his resigning is unusual. A lot of politicians just try and cling to power as long as they possibly can. So it's kind of interesting that he's decided to go on his own terms. Before anyone pushed him.
That is interesting. And there's lots of speculation as to what exactly is going on in the boardrooms of Fine Gael to make this happen. But who knows? At this stage, maybe you'll know by the time this is, or maybe there's nothing to tell. But if there is anything, I'm sure it will come out eventually. Any intrigue. But that what you were saying about his kind of palpable social awkwardness goes hand in hand with that frankness that you're talking about as well, which does make quite a contrast to not just international politicians who were around at the same time as him, but also to a lot of other Irish politicians who might be a little bit plum-oshing. So plum-oshing being this kind of particularly Irish art of flattery, kind of a silly stuff. Like, it's easy to forget, but the Taoiseach that immediately preceded Leo Varadkar, there was kind of a train of fairly silly Taoiseach that had come before him. Like, there was one who, like, there was speculation in the press about him actually being drunk, like, while making public announcements and stuff. Like, this was the kind of stuff we were dealing with, like, not that long ago. So even compared to a lot of Irish politicians, he did have a grown-up air about him. Does have a grown-up air about him. He's not quite gone yet. There's that. Okay, but I wanted to put that as well in the context of how much flack he got in those instances. So during Brexit, he was slaughtered. That's not true, actually, because it was such an ineffectual slaughtering, quote unquote. He was targeted so hard and so crassly by the British press. Like, his face on the British tabloids appearing every day, like lumpy Varadkar, or like, I don't know, trying to make some kind of like names for him. Like, Airhead, I think, was one they called him. Like, there was definitely a tone of homophobia in it. Kind of trying to show him up as like superficial or something like that. You know, that's always something that's put at his door, that he's superficial or that he's silly or that he's girlish or something. There's a kind of homophobic streak in the criticism that he gets, not just from the British press, also from the Irish press. But the British press was awful on him at that stage. And then he had to deal with all of the kind of lunacy criticism during COVID. Like, you're not doing it this way, you're not doing it that way, not just from conspiracy theorists, but from all kinds of sectors of society who thought that they could do it better. We all remember that. Like, every day somebody else was coming out saying, no, this has to be approached in a different way. He had to deal with all that as well. And often that was quite personal and vindictive as well, the criticism that he got. So I think, like, despite his, like, many failings and despite many places where he's fallen down, he has gotten a particularly personal set of attacks on him as a Taoiseach that I don't think a straight politician would have gotten. I think a female politician probably would have had a similar experience. You know, it's all in the kind of slight undertones of what's said or the criticisms that just wouldn't have been launched at another person, I think, that he had to deal with during this time.
Definitely in the British press, there was... He stood out and he seemed to be targeted for standing out. And it was recognisable in that the caricature of Leo Varadkar was not recognisable to a domestic audience. Some like hard bitten nationalist who was, you know, some kind of extremist when he's, you know, this kind of like middle of the ground guy who was actually, you know, always kind of trying to be fair to Britain and saying how much he admired it and things like that. So that was... The animosity was particularly ferocious towards him, including among some of the unionist community in Northern Ireland who were particularly opposed to Brexit as well. He got death threats from, I think, some of the loyalist groups, the paramilitaries. There was definitely there was an edge of animosity. And within Ireland as well, he's been targeted by the fringes of the kind of conspiracy-minded right-wing movements that we've seen come up more or less since the pandemic. The kind of people who go and picket politicians' houses they've targeted Varadkar very directly, and including with, I mean, just straightforwardly homophobic slurs. It's been part of the kind of the conspiracy growth in Ireland has been a focus on Varadkar as well. So definitely, I agree with you that there was personalized animosity towards him that was to do with him sticking out, both as, you know, being a gay man and also as being mixed race. So that's definitely an aspect and probably can't be easy. So it's interesting now, when he did resign, a lot of the Fine Gael party itself expressed surprise. So it wasn't something that was pre-planned. I was getting texts from people being kind of like, you know, shocked and so on. I know some senior politicians had to sort of cancel appearances, change their plans in order to adapt to this. I don't think there was a, you know, kind of a coordinated party plan on this. But what was very interesting, if we can move to the sequel to what's happened here, is that a certain Simon Harris, former health minister, was ready to go so fast the following morning in starting his campaign to replace Varadkar that almost no other candidates got a chance, which was really interesting.
Right. Now, this was, the only other big name that was being thrown around straight away was Simon Coveney. And something that binds Simon Harris and Simon Coveney together was their outsized role during the pandemic. So these are two people who really came to prominence in the public's mind during the pandemic. I mean, sorry, that's not fair. They both had very accomplished careers before that. But they played these big roles in the pandemic, which would have put them, on the tip of everyone's tongue. But Simon Coveney bowed out fairly quickly.
Yeah, we had there was always a number of figures who were sort of seen as potential Fine Gael leaders. Another one would be Helen McEntee, the Justice Minister. There's a few of them sort of seen as kind of up and coming people who could potentially contest a leadership contest. And Simon Coveney had done himself in the past, so he was on the list. Also Pascal Donoghue, the Minister for Public Expenditure. He's also seen as someone who might be interested in the leadership, but nobody else declared in the end. So very quickly, it appears, according to my political colleagues in the Irish Times who were sort of reporting on this closely, the phone calls began to be made very quickly in the morning, and Simon Harris seemed to have been preparing the ground, laying the ground for this. And so he was calling around, or his team were calling around, to, you know, ensure they were sure of people's support. And then a number of figures from Fine Gael, starting with, I think, Senator Neil Richmond, went on the radio and declared that they would be supporting Simon Harris. So this sort of momentum was driven very, very early on. And then, you know, quite soon, all of those potential papabili, or people who were seen as potential leadership candidates, began to say that they wouldn't run. So Simon Harris emerged essentially unopposed to become the leader of Fine Gael. And we assume the next Taoiseach, the vote hasn't taken place, but the coalition government is still in place. It means that, you know, unless they have a massive falling out, the whoever's the new Fine Gael leader should be approved as Taoiseach. Now, the opposition parties have been calling for an election, but it's kind of, if they don't have the votes to sort of force that, then Simon Harris would become the new Taoiseach. So who is he? Shall we talk a little bit about who is the young Harris?
Yeah, very young Harris, right? He's the youngest ever Taoiseach, as far as I understand. He's 37?
He's 37. I think he will be the youngest Taoiseach if he gets to be Taoiseach. So yes, 37. He was kind of a really, just always, like, one of the most noticeable things about him in politics was how young he was. He became a councillor super young. I think he was the youngest TD when he got elected to national politics. He's from Greystones, which is a fishing village. It's in Wicklow, so the county that adjoins Dublin, but it's kind of a Dublin commuter town. It's on the Dart Line, so a lot of people live there and work in Dublin. He emerged advocating for autism services. His brother has autism or conditions, and he was advocating for, you know, greater care. And that's sort of the background he came out of. But he sort of looks a bit, or his presentation is kind of a little bit old for his years, you know. He was health minister, as you say. Kind of, I don't know, there's something about him, you know, he's kind of got salt and pepper hair, he stoops a little bit. He kind of gives me a De Valera vibe. I don't know, there's something about how he presents himself, which
old,
is super traditional.
I mean, not to say that he looks physically old, he looks his age, but he wears the clothes of an older politician, like kind of slightly ill-fitting suits and unkempt hair a little bit. His hair. I mean, he could do with a haircut. I would send that man to a barber and say, short back and sides, please, bring it close. Like, okay, give him a good haircut.
Message to Harris team. Tim has some style advice.
To his own, yeah. And maybe, you know, honestly, like, I remember being a very young teacher at university. I was only maybe 25, and I would be teaching students who were 22. And I used to try and dress old just so that they would even know that I was a teacher when I walked into the room, which wasn't always the case, you know. So it was weird. It was hard to assert your authority otherwise. And maybe being such a young politician for so long, that's just something that he's gotten himself into. It's worked for him.
That would make sense. So his character, like, politically, has a reputation as quite a strong debater. He's featured in a couple of referendum campaigns. I think the repeal abortion referendum, as I recall, he had a strong enough role in that. So he's seen as a kind of reliable guy you can put in front of the cameras. He's got a pretty successful Instagram page where he does these live streams where he talks directly to camera. Okay, a couple of times I've opened Instagram and Simon Harris has just been talking directly to me, and it's like a little bit takes me aback sometimes, you know. Anyway,
I didn't know that that's what they were like. I've heard about his Instagram, but I never knew it was like him just talking to camera.
Oh,
right.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a bit like Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez in the United States. He's like, she's, you know, she'll be like, oh, wrecked, you know, had a hard day in Congress or whatever. He's a bit like that. But he'll just give the lowdown or whatever, usually late at night after the sort of political day is done. He'll speak directly to his followers, you know, on Instagram. Now, how much that translates into votes remains to be seen now. He's got a young family, young kids, and that's it. And we were saying before we were recording that all of this change, this probably adds to the likeliness that Ireland is going to face an election. We have to have an election, I believe, by March 2025. As I said, the opposition parties were saying change of Taoiseach should be an election. You know, Fine Gael just shouldn't be allowed to choose by itself who's Taoiseach. And we'll see. These moments of change and dynamism does sometimes lead to changes in government. We do have a bunch of elections coming up, including the European elections in June, local elections, I think, too. So there's, you know, a potential we could have an early one, although they're saying no so far.
Okay, right. And that would be understandable. If Simon Harris is named Taoiseach, then he'll want to have a few months in that role, you'd imagine, before calling an election anyway. But yeah, like you say, like there's a lot going on. We'll see what happens there.
Who knows? Maybe he'll be like, we need momentum and we're just going to go for election now. Who knows? We can see.
Right. Yeah. You know, I mean, that brings up Fine Gael's prospects in an upcoming election. because this whole change of Taoiseach, of course, is coming hot on the heels of two referendums that were very much seen as lost by the government, right? Two referendums that were put forth by Fine Gael and that really had a crushing defeat in the polls.
Yes, and this is an aspect to the resignation of Radker, which we didn't touch on, but I think it, you know, no doubt sets a bit of the background. It was a big political defeat for the government. So the government had proposed changing two elements of the Irish constitution. We have a written constitution. If it needs to be changed, it has to be done so by referendum. So Ireland has referendums quite regularly to change things in the constitution. It's not that unusual. In this case, the two proposed changes were sort of taking aim at the way in which the constitution emerged out of a particular social context. So one article, for example, states that the state recognizes the family as the natural, primary, and fundamental unit group of society and as a moral institution possessing inalienable and imprescriptible rights, antecedent and superior to all positive law. And it also says the state pledges itself to guard with special care the institution of marriage on which the family is founded and to protect it against attack. So that's one. That kind of, you know, as we've discussed before on the podcast, this constitution was drawn up at a time of quite strong Catholic conservatism in Ireland, overseen by De Valera, De Valera, who we mentioned.
1937.
Yes,
and
that's right.
Not forgetting that De Valera was besties with a fairly reactionary religious figure, McQuaid, who we'll make an episode on in future. There was definitely Catholic influence directly on this constitution. Like there would have been Catholic figures whispering in his ear as he wrote this, and you can see that all over the language. The family being this, you know, like sacred unit, and a marriage. Of course, marriage in a Catholic country, which had at that point to make a decision whether divorce was going to be legal or not after independence. You know. Anyway, sorry. Go on.
The next article similarly reflects the social context of the time and the particular context of this constitution being drawn up. This is what the government also wanted to change, is that the article is, in particular, the state recognizes that by her life within the home, woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. The state, therefore, shall endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in the home. Yeah. So this stuff about duties in the home, life within the home and stuff, that obviously is a particular characterization of women's life in society that reflects the context in which the constitution was made. And the government proposed to change those things. So to change this marriage and family language and to change the women within the home. So this was proposed earlier this year. So will I tell you what they wanted to put in instead?
Yes, Naomi, tell me all about it, because honestly, a lot of this passed me by.
So I think the idea of changing at least some of these bits of the constitution was proposed by Ireland's Citizens Assembly, as I recall. So that was group of representative citizens representing the different groups of Ireland that were brought together to consider certain questions. It was an initiative that got a lot of international attention. It led to the repeal of the Eighth Amendment and other things as well. There was a clear desire to maybe get rid of this language or change it. Not that clear what to change it to. And the debate about what to do about that went on for some time. Mm-hmm. What the government came up with is that instead of the family language, the stuff about the family unit and protecting the institution of marriage, the constitution would read instead, the state recognizes the family, whether founded on marriage or on other durable relationships, as the natural, primary, and fundamental unit group of society, and as a moral institution possessing inalienable and imprescriptible rights, antecedent and superior to all positive law. And then they would delete the stuff about protecting marriage against attack and the special care for the institution of marriage. Then, so I suppose we can deal with that one first. This idea of durable relationships sort of took off in a slightly bizarre way. Did you follow that debate?
I did, yes, I did follow that debate. And from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, the idea behind this was to give increased constitutional protection to people in long-term relationships who just weren't married, right? Or people who had kids who weren't married. And that this kind of almost fetishized nature of marriage in the Constitution almost made it impossible to give equal treatment, I suppose, to people who were facing the exact same issues, but they didn't have this specific legal paper between them. So I understand that that was the idea, right? Because we have to remember as well that since the legalization of same-sex marriage, there is no civil partnerships in Ireland, as I understand, anymore. It's you're either married or you're not. There's nothing in between. Yeah. So there's a lot of people who aren't married out there, but who are effectively living in common law, if you will, marriages, so to speak. So yeah, was that the idea?
The idea is, yeah, just to give recognition to different family units of different kinds. Not necessarily, you know, man, woman, married, this kind of thing. Essentially the proposal opened the floodgates of debate about what is a durable relationship. There was some slightly silly talk about throuples and things like that.
We'll be marrying goats, Naomi. We'll be marrying dogs.
Yeah,
oh, exactly. Ha, 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 the madness that will ensue. Sorry. Yeah. Please continue.
Apparently there was some concern that it might lead to problems with inheritance. You know, that if someone had an affair or something, that it would be recognized as equally valid to a marriage, things like that. But, you know, I think the side that was in favor of proposing these changes was saying that this wasn't going to be an issue. But yeah, this did become, I think, a slightly negative debate. Then in terms of the other proposals regarding the woman's life in the home and the duties in the home and stuff, what the government proposed was to write in something which is about care in the home in general. So the changes, it would read instead, the state recognises that the provision of care by members of a family to one another by reason of the bonds that exist among them gives to society a support without which the common good cannot be achieved, and shall strive to support such provision. So they would put this strive to support care provision in. Something interesting happened with this. This turned out to be really divisive, particularly among disabled people. So there was a view that the assumption that it's the duty of the family to provide care was, you know, a retrograde one, that people should be able to have independent lives, and that this was a sort of a way for the state to wiggle out of its own obligations to citizens that need care. So there was actually quite a movement. It was divisive. I don't think it was all disabled groups representing the disabled community who were against it, but there was quite a strong reaction against it among some. And who, you know, they were saying that this, this strive to provide, strive to support it wasn't good enough language by the state. You can't vow to sort of strive to do something. Would perhaps make more concrete the situation of carers who feel that they have inadequate support from the state.
Yeah, it is a little bit opaque. As language goes, to strive to kind of, that already includes that presupposes the idea that we may not succeed. That's, you know, tried our best, .com. So not great there. But that whole passage you read was quite abstract in its language. But I suppose that's what you have to do if you're writing this stuff. In kind of modern language, in modern legalistic language, it has to be so abstract, because otherwise you end up making incredibly huge consequences where you don't intend them to be.
I think the government was nervous about committing to a certain level of support that would lead to challenges. So if people felt there was some statement that care had to be supported in the Constitution, and they had not been sufficiently, they had not received sufficient support in that way, they could take like a legal challenge saying that, you know, the state had failed its constitutional obligation, something like that. So this is the kind of tightrope I think the government was walking. Mm-hmm. They wanted to recognize something to do with care, but without promising too much.
Right.
And so unfortunately, I think, although the stuff about women in the home and kind of maybe not including that anymore was relatively popular, this proposed change was seen as mishandled. Will I tell you the results, Tim?
Well, yeah, I suppose. Yeah, let's get to it. Let's go to the let's go straight to the results.
A resounding defeat for the government. So when it came to the family amendment about recognizing other sorts of durable relationships and so on, 67% no. When it came to the care amendment, which would have replaced the women in the home language and put in that stuff about strive to support, 74% no. So absolutely like resounding rejection. Turnout was slightly over 44%, so not particularly high. But yeah, the government was comprehensively defeated on this. And they sort of acknowledged that quite early on in the count, that it was clear that it had been rejected. Now we can pick into the reasons why. Kind of broad ill feeling in the government, confusion, it seems, over the meaning of the referendums, what it would change, things like that. Lack of clear explanation. There was definite like hardcore opposition to it from more conservative elements as well, who like that there's recognition of the family. Yeah, who like the women in the home thing. You know, some women were saying, no, we want recognition of, you know, care that women provide to children in the home and stuff. We do not want this role of women to be taken out of the constitution. So, you know, I think it was a very mixed bag of reasons, but it was comprehensively defeated in the end.
Yeah. And it's worth saying for the listeners, just in this context, that there is a certain reactionary sector in society who live for these referendums. You could have a referendums on like puppies, good or bad, you know, and like this reactionary group would go haywire saying that they were bad. You know, it's just no to everything. They just say no to everything because they feel under siege, basically, from the world around them. And I think, like, I would say that they missed the authority they used to have in old Catholic Ireland, but I think even then they didn't have the authority that they wanted, and they used this as this kind of petty way to assert authority in this horrible kind of small-minded, small-town way. Now, I mean, this is a very diverse group of people. It's not like they have a political party or anything. Just a certain mindset that exists, I would say, a lot in rural Ireland, and I would, like, know it very well growing up. But, I mean, the fact that they exist isn't like remarkable. There's a kind of, you know, reactionary little core in most societies, I would say. I'd say if you went anywhere, you know, rural Virginia, rural France, rural Italy, you'll find something very similar to that. People, I don't think, have ever really taken them seriously. So you have to keep that in mind as well. So there is a kind of very loud, very vocal, very no faction that almost appears at every referendum saying no to whatever the referendum is. And people kind of typically or predictably have a bit of a laugh at them. And every now and again they win. And things are, you know, everything's thrown into a bit of a mess for a while and people have to like fix that mess. But usually they don't win. And certainly if they do win, it's not for the reasons that reactionary core have come out about. And this kind of idea, like women are better off in the kitchen barefoot, is a typical kind of argument that you'd hear from them. It's like an argument that you can't really take seriously in the first place.
In the case of this referendum, I mean, that isn't why this happened, though. I mean, if we look at urban constituencies, even constituencies like Dún Laoghaire is like referendum in, referendum out, always. It's always the constituency, Dún Laoghaire, Rathdown, that votes most yes for whatever progressive change it is. And the care amendment, so changing the women in the whole home, that got rejected there as well. It was comprehensive. It was throughout urban constituencies, rural constituencies, like it was across the board.
It was across the board. And from how you lay out the issues at hand there and the problems that people had with them, it seems clear, I suppose, that wasn't actually the issue, which you mightn't actually get if you looked at the international press, because the international press the day afterwards immediately said, the Irish, they haven't changed that much after all. They just, hey, women. Like, that was basically the headline that you saw everywhere. Because that would be what you would presume. But I would say, anecdotally, I mean, just from merely listening to you right there, I would say anecdotally that surely the biggest problem was that people, A, didn't understand, and B, if they did understand, didn't care enough to change it.
Yeah.
Like, what were the stakes really here? You know, for most people, they were fairly low.
A lack of motivation for the yes side, definitely, and widespread confusion and lack of clear information. At least that's what the government was blamed for. And they weren't confident people weren't confident that these changes were good changes. Like, maybe it should be changed, but maybe not this way. So that's how it all shook out. But yes, I agree with you. The international perception was that Catholic Ireland had reasserted itself, which was really interesting to see. I saw loads of headlines like that, like in Italian media and stuff, like, well, they may have voted for same-sex marriage and abortion and stuff, but still they're not ready to give up the place of women in the home and the family and stuff. It was really interesting.
They had to jump in it that way. What else were they going to do? And like,
it was very interesting.
We never win. We're never going to win that battle either. Like, that is... That's the color that we've been painted in the paint by numbers. That is the world. Like, we've been colored in that number. And for decades now, basically, international media has been trying to grapple with the idea that that impression isn't true. And they're much more comfortable just getting right back into that paint by numbers scene or context that they have already set up for them. But, you know, what can you do? What can you do?
All referendums as well are vulnerable to becoming referendums about the government. So, you know, it's also a sort of a big opinion poll about your feelings about the current government and whether you want to give them a punch in the nose or not. So in that sense, it was like kind of test of the mood in the country. And I think, you know, it is fair to link this to the resignation of Leo Varadkar, because it can't be an encouraging sign when you do see an election on the horizon, to think, you know, to see an electoral result like this, and, you know, maybe not to be quite feeling going into a campaign. I would see those things as definitely linked. Interesting side, sort of side note to this is, I mentioned the role of the Citizens' Assembly in sort of proposing these constitutional changes. So the Citizens' Assembly was really excited people as a potential reform of democracy that could have wider application throughout the world after Ireland's repeal of the 8th and same-sex marriage referendums, because that way of handling those two issues had managed to get society to sort of grasp and deal with some topics that had been really contentious and that were complex and people had genuinely mixed feelings about, particularly in the case of abortion, and had managed to create this large society scale level of education, because the proceedings of the Citizens' Assembly went on for months and were reported, and all the different experts and the aspects of it and stuff were reported and talked about, and you could watch it live and all this kind of thing. So it was seen as this interesting experiment in democracy that could kind of maybe revitalize democracy and overcome particularly deadlock on contentious issues. Now, I actually wrote a piece a few years ago for Politico, which was about how this idea of the Citizens' Assembly was way over exaggerated. Citizens' Assemblies are useful tools, definitely, when used in the right way, but they can also be used badly and they can be abused by politicians as well. Like, if they just don't want to deal with something, they can give it to a Citizens' Assembly. And if the premise of the Citizens' Assembly is that the government isn't bound to do anything with the results of the Citizens' Assembly, it literally just kills an issue. It's used as a political tactic to kill reform as well. So it's not necessarily this like cure-all thing. And there was a bit of a craze about them, which has subsided. But yes, this defeat of these referendums now has sort of brought that to light, that it's not always the case that anything that comes out of a Citizens' Assembly is going to be this magic fix that will sort of be a way to resolve reforms that are difficult in society.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? And I mean, even without that, you would think that maybe the government might have been a bit wiser to that, because, like, when you're changing the constitution on a complicated question, the automatic position of the public is going to be, don't change anything, it's fine. Right? Like, surely, right? That, you know, anywhere, not just in Ireland, like, bringing up a referendum, people are generally conservative, like, in the literal sense of the term, in that, like, if it's not broken, don't fix it. Unless there is a big problem that they can sense themselves and that they know to be a problem, the automatic knee-jerk reaction will be just to leave it as it is. And this is very typical with changing the constitution in Ireland. That is a lot of kind of middle Ireland, let's say, is knee-jerk reaction to just leave it as it is if it's not causing any huge issues. And for this one, where the wording was really quite lengthy and difficult to understand and to even get into debating it, people, you know, really had to spend some time understanding what it meant. Even if that's only 10 or 15 minutes, you know, for a lot of people, that's like more time than they have for politics in an afternoon. That would almost tell you straight away that they're either not going to vote or they're going to vote no. It seems like a silly gamble to make on something that, like, the public would be almost kind of predictably reluctant to go with you on.
Well, one thing I can tell you, Tim, is that wherever we go from here, it will be a long time before a government rushes to try to change that wording again, and indeed to hold any kind of referendum on something that maybe isn't like a super urgent issue that's forced upon them. I think, you know, this was a sort of an own goal for the government and something that they kind of went in off their own bat, probably thinking it was the right thing to do. And there was absolutely no upside for them. So I think it's going to be a long time before we see a ballot like that again.
Right. Okay, now, so we'll wrap this up, but just a quick little rundown, Naomi, if you could give us of the other elections that are coming this way and where the other political parties are standing with those elections as well.
In the opinion polls, yeah, good idea. So yeah, we have a number of votes coming up scheduled for Friday, June 7th, 2024. So we have European Parliament elections, the election of Ireland's MEPs, members of the European Parliament. That's going to be an interesting one. We've already seen at the moment candidates are being put forward and things like that. They're being decided by the parties. At the same day, we'll have all the local authorities in Ireland will have their elections as well. And there actually will be another little referendum. It's on the Unified Patent Court. It basically allows the state to ratify a certain agreement, which is regarding a court which settles disputes on patents. It's a little bit of a technical thing, but yeah, the referendum will be held that day as well. There's also going to be, before long, at some point, a general election. It has to happen by March 2024, but, March 2025, but it could happen earlier than that, depending on how things go in politics and whether the government decides to go for it or falls over some issue, which can happen as well. So what we've seen in terms of opinion polls is quite interesting. In 2020, the last election, listeners will probably remember this, there was this huge surge in support for Sinn Féin. They did way better than they themselves expected in the election. And they were riding high in the polls really throughout 2021, 2022, that kind of thing. What we've seen over the last maybe 6 months or so is that enthusiasm for Sinn Féin lag quite a lot. So at the moment, they're quite far off the peaks that they had seen in the past. So just to cite the most recent poll, this is from the 23rd of March. It's by Ireland Thinks and the Sunday Independent, and it's a sample size of 1,300 representative Irish citizens. So Sinn Féin is still in the lead. They're on 27% support, but that's a fair bit down. They were well over 30s. They were in the mid-30s not so long ago. Fine Gael is second on 22%. So that's not that far off Sinn Féin and a closer gap than there would have been in the past. Yeah, and Fianna Fáil is on 17%. And then in terms of the rest of the vote, it's sort of divided among smaller parties. The Green Party seems to have lost a fair bit of its support since the election. It's on 4%. Labour is on 4%. Social Democrats, 6%. The left-wing People Before Profit Solidarity Party is on 2%. And AIM2, which is like a kind of a... It's basically... it was set up by a guy who splintered off from Sinn Féin. It's a bit more right-wing and socially conservative. That's on 4%. And then others, 14%. That includes all the different independents who play such a big role in Irish politics. So as things stand, if we had a referendum right now, you could even see a repeat of the government that we have. It would certainly have to be some sort of coalition because there isn't one party which is like strides ahead of the others in terms of the poll.
Right. Okay. So I suppose Sinn Féin must be kicking themselves a little bit.
I mean,
for missing their chance last time.
Yeah. Well, last time was definitely a good chance for them. Now we'll have to see what happens. Obviously, campaigns change a lot.
Yeah.
And there was a big momentum for change in the last election, I think, that wasn't actually borne out. And I can see that happening again. We'll have to see. But yeah, they'll have to be in coalition with somebody. So it'll kind of be interesting. I mean, almost certainly. It'd be interesting to see what potential outcomes there could be. Certainly, I think people have gotten used to the idea that Sinn Féin is going to be in government next time. But it's not a given. We can see from these results that it's possible that, other parties could be returned again.
All right. And of course, the incumbent new Taoiseach, Simon Harris, is going to have quite a big role to play in that. Now, it's suddenly occurring to me, Naomi, a vague memory of all the way back in 2017 when we gave our good luck, our good wishes to the new Taoiseach, Mr. Varadkar. So I'll say, best of luck to you. Also to the new Taoiseach, Mr. Harris, when you take your seat, and hope you do well by the country, as we all expect you to do.
I think we had him briefly on the podcast, possibly. Way back in the mists of time.
We did have him on the podcast. Sorry, we've also had Leo Varadkar on the podcast. Sure, we have everyone who's everyone on the podcast, Naomi. I mean, listen, listeners, all you need to do is go up to the back catalogue. You'll find all the stars of Irish society have given us exclusive interviews at some point or another. With that, if you want even more content, listeners, you can find it over at our Patreon page. That's www.patreon.com/theirishpassport, where we have over 100 audio episodes of extra content, and more than that, other stuff that isn't audio as well that we upload over there. Loads and loads and loads of stuff, and a growing community of listeners over there who you can communicate with as well.
Tim's cooking videos and recipe videos are particularly popular with a certain subset of our supporters, I must say.
Don't join for the cooking videos. Listeners, I have precisely two. Both of them somehow took me like half an hour to do. And in one, I make a barn brack, and the other, I make pancakes, I think, and potato cakes. Unless you have very little to do with your life, maybe. you can look Tim, those up on all recipes. there's lots of actual really good stuff over there. And if you want as well, you can go over there for one of our listener question episodes. We're about to make one right now where you can write in at a certain tier and ask us to address some of the issues that you would like us to talk about on the Patreon only episodes. And one last thing, that this is what keeps the podcast running. By becoming a patron, you are supporting us and you are making sure that we can keep making shows, which we can't do otherwise. So we thank you to all our patrons for keeping us going.
Massive thanks for that. Yeah, it's absolutely fundamental. Thank you.
All right. And thanks to you, Naomi, for filling us in on this latest political update. And from me, that's Slán.